The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to read new and exciting writings by Sherlockians, or even find information on how to get published in the journal, please visit their website, www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gazadine Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers for The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. Another brilliant book published with Gazadine Books is Matthias Boström and Matt Laffey's Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press, Gazadine Books, or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
So welcome to the Baker Street Babes. Today I'm joined by Kate Tracy. She is the executive producer of the amazing Sherlock web series. And we have the pleasure of speaking with Mr. Paul Cornell. His accomplishments are numerous, too numerous to list, but among them, he is one of two people who have been nominated for a Hugo Award in prose, comics, and television. On a personal note, he's also why I'm a lifelong fan of Doctor Who. He's the writer of Father's Day, which is the episode that actually hooked me into the reboot, and also the highly acclaimed Human Nature and the Family of Blood, which is a great novel. You're very welcome. But today, of course, we are here to talk about your connection with Sherlock Holmes, which is near and dear to our hearts. And so to start off with, we have some questions that we like to ask our guests so that we can induct you as an honorary Baker Street Babe. So
this is the scary initiation part.
Exactly.
This is the hazing. Okay.
This is as hard as it gets, you know.
Well, that's what they said last time.
Okay, well, first of all, it's an easy one. How did you first meet Sherlock Holmes? How did he enter your life?
I think it would be Basil Rathbone movies on television when I was very small. They played them pre-Watershed in the early hours and of the evening. I mean, on BBC when I was tiny, and you know, they have an atmosphere and a speed to them, which is I think could still be very pleasing for children. Well, I haven't put a child in front of one recently, so I don't know. But that was my first encounter.
We have a lot of people say that they encountered those as kids. So I do think, and that, you know, that's kind of the thing that hooked them in. So I think that you're right about that. They do have like a particular speed and appeal that you can kind of get into at a young age.
I'm not still a fan tremendously. Nigel Bruce is a lovely character actor, but I get the feeling the idea of Watson being like that was in the air before he came along, but he certainly cemented it.
Yes.
And Basil Rathbone, it's kind of vanilla, liking Basil Rathbone. It's like, oh, really? Nothing more interesting? I mean, he's great. He's in Robin Hood. My goodness, he's a fantastic villain. Mm-hmm. He's fantastic in Universal Frankenstein, but he's default Sherlock.
Have you ever listened to the Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone radio show adaptations of Sherlock Holmes?
No, I have not. Are they different?
They are fantastic because it's just their voices. So it's how you picture Sherlock and it's how you picture Watson. But they're on Spotify and they're wonderful. I highly, highly recommend them if you like Basil Rathbone.
Well, I've got to say, I find Nigel Bruce very cuddleable. I think he's very sweet. Yes.
And those stories are really sweet because they're set up as old-time radio shows where the advertising is built in. So the setup is that the Petri and Wine guy shows up at Watson's house every story.
Oh,
and
really?
They're amazing. They're amazing. I highly, highly recommend them.
Lord Holmes, I love this wine. This is delicious.
Exactly. And so they have a glass of Petri wine, and then they tell a story, and it's awesome.
Hey, for our listeners, you know, that's, I'm sure we probably mentioned it before, but you guys should check those out on, those are available on Spotify. Kate, do you want to take question two of our honorary babe quiz here?
I will. My second question, sir, is which is your favorite canon story?
Ooh, I think I like the Red-Headed League. It's an example I bring up sometimes. You hear it in writers' rooms. Could we do a Red-Headed League with this? It's the kind of the first of a whole genre of stories, in that it's the most fantastic red herring. And it's just so immensely clever.
Excellent choice. And I think I felt some shades of Red-Headed League in your novel, which we'll get to in a bit here.
Probably there's loads of them in there. But anyway, do go. Yes.
Lots of references to lots of stories, which we will dive into. Question three is, do you have a favorite Holmes adaptation? And you are allowed to say your own or one that you've written for.
Oh, I know I'm not going to say my own. Dear me. let me see. What... I'm a sucker for Jeremy Brett. When they're at their peak, maybe second or third season, they're kind of definitive. I know people don't like Brett's kind of tics and eccentricities, but I think he finds things. He makes Holmes human in a way which actually he hadn't been for the longest time until that point, and. You know, he finds a person in there, a very vulnerable person, actually. And I think, and especially the quality of the adaptations, the way they look for period detail and ways to flesh out the story in authentic ways. Also, they found two different Watsons who played it in almost exactly the same way.
Yes.
So even though they look quite physically different, they're quite hard to tell apart in a strange way.
That's an excellent point, actually, and it did begin, hopefully at least, a journey toward Watson being more of a humanized and viable part of the partnership.
Well, I see our own wonderful Sherlock Watson, Martin Freeman.
Yes.
I think he's watched one or both of those Watsons, or all of their research into post-traumatic stress disorder has gone to the same place, because you see them doing the same things. I think either they did the same research and came to the same conclusions, or Martin Freeman has watched that particular Watson, because you do see certain little moments, certain little reactions, which are very similar. He's a very good watcher, Edward Hardwick. The first one is...
David Burke.
That's the one. Yeah. I think they're very good Watsons.
Yeah, we're huge, huge Brett and Granada fans on the podcast, and we do think it, at this point in time, now that we kind of have the resurgence, which you've written a lot in your book about Holmes mania, which was really amusing to read, I think the Granada series really bisects the modern media history of Holmes and really was a definitive game changer, which is a great thing to go back and watch and really, like you said, see a humanity to Holmes that really hadn't been there. Well, we do have a couple more. You're almost an honorary babe. I know you're holding your breath here, but anyway, Kate,
I wonder where this is going.
Oh, they're not bad, I promise. You want to take the next one, Kate?
I will. It says, which original character is your favorite?
Well, there aren't. It would be really odd at this point to say Mrs. Hudson, wouldn't it? Because they're not many of them are fleshed out. But in terms of maybe of one-off characters,
it's okay. We have a lot of people say Mrs. Hudson, actually.
Right. Sebastian Moran.
Mm.
There's something really satisfying about his villainy. And it's kind of on screen and in your face in a way which Moriarty in the original canon never was.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of muscular villainy, which is very enjoyable.
That's a great point. And he's also more of a through line. I mean, he in some ways almost has more of a canon presence, like you're saying, than Moriarty does. Although Moriarty kind of has that arch nemesis status. Moran is the one who, you know, kind of keeps hammering away at it for the, you know, period of time during the hiatus and whatever.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Coenville did an amazing job of selling Moriarty to us. In that, you know, he just tells us a lot how just what a huge villain he is, and thus inscribes him onto popular culture for all time in one right. single short story. It's extraordinary. Having him kill the hero and right. force the hero to regenerate. I've just written a piece about how Holmes invents regeneration.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that we rarely go an episode without mentioning Doctor Who. Not just because we're fans, which we are, but also because of that odd connection there, which he is kind of he's the superhero and the regenerating Time Lord, and so many things kind of come from that.
It's the invention of popular fiction. Sorry.
Anyway. No, you're fine.
But I refer the honorable ladies to my forthcoming blog post. But anyway.
Oh, yes. and that is through your website, right? Which we should mention.
No, we're trying to pitch it to Tor as part of the blog tour for the book.
Oh, excellent!
So, yeah, but anyway, please continue the initiation.
No, we'll stay tuned for that. We definitely will. Last question: we used to have these questions kind of together, but we decided to separate them because people tend to have different answers for this than their favorite character. And the question is, what character would you most like to go and have a drink with?
Oh, Watson! Of course, it's Watson. I mean, Holmes would not be very fun at all. I mean, why would he be having a drink with me unless I'd done something?
I love that, yeah.
but no, Watson, I think, would be tremendously sociable and really good fun. You get the feeling that Watson's a lot more fun when he's away from Holmes.
Yes, that's a great point. And we kind of see him, you know, at least alluded to having some friendships outside Holmes, like Stamford and people like that. But yeah, he's a little more of a socially average guy.
And of course, he's been married a variable number of times, so it must be doing something right.
Variable is a great word there. But
his wives are like Schrodinger's cats. You know, there's a variable number of them.
Do they know his name? Do we know who they are? We are not sure. So you are now an honorary Baker Street Babe. So congratulations!
Thank you very much.
We'll put your Holmes themed bikini in the mail or not.
Ooh. I'm delighted to be a babe. I've never been a babe before. I have been a babe. You know, when I was tiny.
Oh well, yes. English semantics here. Okay, well, I do want to move into talking about your absolutely remarkable book, "Who Killed Sherlock Holmes," which I have just read, which was hugely enjoyable. And I first want to talk about the fact that this is book three in a series. And I will say, we recommend that our listeners read all three of the books. But jumping into book three, I actually didn't find that I was unable to join the flow of the story.
Oh, great. That's really reassuring, because we did put some work into giving an intro for new readers and bringing them up to speed. So, because we get the feeling that a lot of new people may join at this point.
Right, right. Obviously, Sherlock Holmes is a popular guy these days. But I do want to ask, given a lot, obviously, the pastiche culture, we have a lot of people writing Sherlock Holmes novels, something I do on the side, and it's a lot of people write Sherlock Holmes series. You're writing a series in which Sherlock Holmes is coming into it part of the way. What was your inspiration for kind of this world that you've created and Sherlock Holmes coming in now?
Well, the world is modern-day London with a supernatural twist, which is that the city remembers things. Our heroes are a normal team of undercover London police officers who suddenly gain the ability to see all the dark, magical, monstrous stuff in the shadows. And all of that stuff is remembered by the city. And the city remembers both real people and fictional characters. Anything the population of London, both living and dead, collectively recall is part of that mass of supernatural stuff our heroes have to deal with. And so I suddenly realised that amongst all the ghosts of Jack the Ripper, who was very much featured in book two, and real figures like that, there are also going to be some big fictional characters. And I suddenly thought, Sherlock Holmes is going to be very, very present in this city, and he's going to be really present at a specific location, which is 221B Baker Street, which is a museum now. And, of course, not having properly existed until it was a museum, but, of course, that's where London will put him. And so I thought, how can I get him involved? I don't want to do some kind of team-up, because I think that would demean the character a bit and sort of sideline my own detectives.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, oh, Who Killed Sherlock Holmes? It's just a title that came into... It's one of those moments where a title comes into your head and you think, oh, yeah, that... And so the book starts with him, his ghost, intangibly lying on the floor of 221B in the museum with a dagger through his back, a ceremonial dagger, and our heroes are just astonished at how could you kill a ghost? Why would you want to kill a ghost? And he's flickering through all the different versions of Sherlock Holmes that have ever been. And it's a crime scene. His study, fictionally created as part of the museum, has had all sorts of strange things done to it. And that was just my inspiration. I thought, well, I must find out who killed him. And so I did, and I wrote the book as I went.
I love that. So few people that we talk to, authors, write as they go, like write to find out. And that's how I write about Sherlock Holmes as well, is I start with sort of a premise, and then I want to find out what happens, and that's why I write too. So I love that. Yeah.
I think it's a way to do it. I must say, I solved it in plotting before I started actually writing the book.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Well, and it does, I mean, the book, I won't spoil anything, but it does have amazing twists throughout it that I was not seeing coming. I do love, you mentioned that this kind of amazingly visceral scene that takes place in the Sherlock Holmes Museum. And what I was really struck by reading it is what a classic beginning of a Holmes story this is. It feels like you're kind of coming into a crime scene that maybe Sherlock Holmes himself, you know, even a very traditional Victorian Sherlock Holmes, you know, he'd be investigating, he'd be deducing, he'd be looking at the mantelpiece, he'd be looking at things that have been moved around, just like your detectives are doing. And yet we have this overlay, this supernatural element. And it's just so fascinating to me that the fusion of that works so brilliantly together, I think.
Thank you. Well, that's why Castaigne has to say at the end of the chapter, guys, the game is afoot.
Oh, yes. I love that.
And of course, the whole book is about a series of murders to which this is somehow related, where the criminals are doing what happened in the Sherlock Holmes original canon in order, and actually getting that into correct modern London locations was perhaps the most difficult bit of the book.
Oh yes.
There are some really useful online resources for where things might have happened in the world of Holmes.
Oh, yes, definitely. The sort of people playing the game and kind of developing the, you know, real-world equivalents for some of his fictional...
Oh, and a lot of the streets have changed, of course. So I had to sort of work out where something would have been before a dirty great Tesco's got plonked on it and things like that.
And obviously that really pays off because the book feels very immediate. It's a fantasy book that feels very grounded in reality. I felt like, as someone who's been to London, though never lived there, I felt very much like I could see locations I had been to and really feel that the kind of the mythology that you've created arises from London itself. It feels like a very organic fantasy world that's London-based, and that be my favorite thing about it, actually, is that feeling that this is a mythology specific to this city, which is really beautiful.
Well, thank you. I mean, Holmes himself is so plugged into London. I mean, Conan Doyle so makes a point of when Holmes leaves London of going, oh, he's leaving London. And Holmes himself goes, oh, I'm leaving London. And it's kind of the connection between the detective and the city. That's something else Conan Doyle invents. You know, that Batman and Gotham.
Yes.
That's straight from Conan Doyle, like so many things in modern pop culture.
Oh, that's an excellent point. I love it. It's definitely that atmospheric quality. And it strikes me that a lot of your work is kind of fused. Like something, I'm even thinking back to something like Father's Day, which uses a very science fiction element to explore kind of really touching human drama.
Well, thank you.
And that's, this book is similar to that in that you're exploring some very deep things, and I don't want to spoil specifics, but that these characters have been through in previous, books that you've written and everything. And I just want to ask you to talk a little bit about that process of fusing such a supernatural world with such kind of human experiences.
Well, that's sort of my whole game. It's what I most enjoy doing. Russell T. Davis called opening a vein. He would say, open a vein for me. And that makes him sound vaguely sinister. I love fantasy, but the kind of fantasy I most enjoy is deeply grounded, not necessarily in the realities of the everyday world, although often it is, like these books, but reflecting human experience very, very much. And I think actually a lot of fantasy writers would say the same. There's that awful get-out authors sometimes say of, well, unlike all other fantasy, my fantasy is about real people. I'm not saying that at all.
I understand.
I equate lots of my early emotional creation and who I am as a person with fantasy stories. In a lot of my my family life was very disrupted, and I spent a lot of time away with science fiction and Doctor Who and things like that in my own little world. And I sort of came to equate the big feelings of life, the feels, with those texts. And so I think it's my job to continue that into writing, to bring the feels to science fiction. Oh, goodness, I have a mission statement, thanks to you. Hooray! I am going to bring the feels to science fiction. Except I can't do that because, of course, they were already here. Sorry, establish that. Yes.
I think you do a wonderful job. One of the great things about your just overall work is that it's so grounded not only in everything you just said, but in the history of the genre. Reading it, I feel like this is an author who has read science fiction, who has read comics, and understands kind of the expectations that the audience is looking for. And
oh, yeah, thank you.
And can really kind of find that balance between totally fanboying, but also being a professional kind of writer telling their own story. And that, when you find someone who can write that way as a fan, it's just, it's gold. You can't get any better than that, I have to say.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, as a Sherlock fan, this book was like that. It was kind of, how do I restrain myself from just having the characters waving their hands in the air going, woo, and running through this? And because you're right, it could be bad. It could just be a wallow, a really self-indulgent thing. And Well, I think another reason I bring the feels is because it kind of stops you wallowing. This is a really strange metaphor I've got involved in here. The feels stop me wallowing. Thank you.
We know what you mean, though. It's the idea that bringing it, which I think Russell Davis, his entire era of Doctor Who was characterized by this, but grounding.
Oh, yeah. Russell very much does exactly this. Sorry.
No. But grounding those fantastical elements through the humanity really is something that works well. And I do, since you mentioned kind of the integrating your ideas of Sherlock and everything, I have to point out that this is a very funny book as well for people who might not expect that. And I didn't know that coming into it. Obviously, I know that you have a lot of humor in your television writing, but this book has some serious, heavy topics. But at the same time, we have things like 3 primary Sherlock Holmes adaptations filming in London at the same time, and maybe some satirical elements. I don't know if I was just superimposing my own thoughts on that, or if you have some comments on that.
Fondly satirical. I mean, I just wanted to do a take on the modern Holmes industry. And so, have a series of movies, a modern day American Sherlock series, and a classical BBC adaptation all happening at the same time. And of course, the three actors are potential victims in the series of crimes. And so our leads get to interview them. And in one case, they get considerably closer with one of them than that. Mm-hmm. And it's just letting me play with the modern Holmes culture in a fun way. I mean, I've got quotes both from Rob Doherty of Elementary and Stephen Moffat on this book, so I think I'm safe. I don't think they're going to murder me.
Oh, well, that's good. No, I mean, there's such a fondness and you know, the amount of research, obviously, as a big fan of the canon, reading through it, I kept being so excited by, you know, these are kind of copycat murders in a way, so there are so many references back to the canon, and so much love for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle as well, which was just a lot of fun to read as a fan.
Me and my copy editor went through with a fine tooth comb, but I'm just waiting for a fan of the original canon to point out something like, but you missed, and we'll just fall over and go, we missed it. I'm just waiting. It's going to happen.
Oh boy. Yeah, always, I think. Kate, did you want to interject?
Oh, I was just going to say that, again, going back to the idea of someone who might not have read the original two books, but is picking this up for the first time. It's such a startling and fun prologue. It ends with the Rachen, right? Is that a pronounce? I can't pronounce German.
Rush, I think.
Rush. Yeah, it ends with Rush. And you're just immediately like, oh, yeah, we're going to get, you know, like, you're just kind of jumping up in your seat, you know, excited. Because, again, as someone who reads the canon, you're like, study the Scarlet. Where it's going. Let's go. Right now. Woo! Let's read more.
Thank you so much. I mean, I figured that would work both ways, in that for people who don't know it, they'd go, ooh, that's a strange and intriguing word. And for canon fans, they'd just go, pow. So thank you. Thank you.
I also love, I love that, because, yeah, all those different things, and even some of the lesser known stories, you have the characters kind of going through sequentially and talking about, is there a murder, isn't there a murder? It's a little bit of like a survey of Holmes, not constantly, but kind of through the book, which I really, really enjoyed that. And I hope, you know, that it will kind of encourage people to go back to the canon as well, and maybe find out for themselves what some of those stories are about.
Oh, well, thank you. We very much wanted to, because the series of murders is every single one from the Holmes canon in order of publication, which is a tiny spoiler, but there we are. It's because that's something my heroes have to figure out. You know, they're wondering if those Holmes stories which don't have a murder, that they'll also somehow be committed. What, you know, and there's even some where no crimes happen. So that's kind of a grey area. But no, it's just the murders. And getting them done in order, that was a very tough aspect of the book.
I'm sure.
I had a really good copy editor who really read up on his Holmes and was my safety net and made sure we don't think missed anything.
Yeah, no, I think it was absolutely perfect and just such a fun thing. We are the Baker Street Babes, so I do want to comment on your just absolutely superlative female characters.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Just such a thrill, and obviously we live for and hope for a day and time when that's not an unusual thing, but it still can be. And so we appreciate that, and also, in particular, you do have an actress portraying a female Holmes. And I love that concept, which in a minute here we'll go over to Elementary, which obviously has a strong female presence. But thank you for that. And do you have any comments specifically about your kind of crafting of female characters?
Well, I tend to go at female characters kind of like they're also me. I mean, I think that as a male writer, you'd think it's easier for you to inhabit male characters because you've got to inhabit all of them. I always say they've all got to be your Mary Sues, every single damn one of them, mm-hmm. all the characters. And so I just try not to put a barrier between myself and inhabiting the female characters fully as well, because then that's just them being people. And I think it's also very important to represent. I think deliberate diversity is the only way to do it. Diverse characters are not going to grow like mustard and cress naturally, as people put it in the pages of a book, if you leave it out in the rain, you know. It's got to be an author deciding to do that. And so I believe in doing it deliberately. And Ross.
You can't see me, but I'm nodding my head right now.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, Kate's web series has actually a female Sherlock Holmes, and they are very lots of diversity with sexualities and personal identity, which your book also explores, but not in a way of like, look, here's a token character, but these people are just people involved in this story, and that's refreshing.
Well, thank you. I asked a transgender friend of mine about where to place the transgender character in the narrative, and they were insistent that in a book with a lot of weird people in it, that the transgender character is always the weird one. And so I made her actually the symbol of domestic normality that Quill is trying to get back to. Because honestly, that's the place that almost all transgender people are in other people's lives. You know, it's very hard to do any character in a book who is just that person standing over there. Because, you know, why are they in the narrative?
Right.
But I think it's very important for people like... For people like transgender characters to not have a reason to be there. It's always what people ask about their presence in the narrative. Why are they there? Well, because they're there in real life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the deliberate thing. I adore Ross, my intelligence officer, analyst. Really, all five of the main characters are kind of an aspect of me. And the way that she's driven is kind of really important to me. And she's damaged in ways which I relate to. Also, Lofthouse, their boss.
Yes.
Who becomes kind of very much part of the team in this one. I just really like the idea of having an older woman. The boss in a lot of modern crime dramas is where you put the diverse character because they won't be in it very much, honestly. And it's kind of a safe place to put them almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the book where I draw her into the team and sort of fold her in and make her entirely a part of it. The new covers actually have magical designs on the front that are actually meaningful for that. And this one's a pentagram, meaning that the five of them all take a full part in the story.
Oh, right. Oh, excellent. Yeah.
Sorry, I've been going on and on. Forgive me.
That's excellent. Hey, that's why you're here, is for you to go on about your work. I love Lofthouse as well. She's made me think of kind of an Olivia Colman kind of character who that really, really strong, doesn't need to be, you know, a 20-year-old sort of ingenue, but has that presence and that sort of force of character of a slightly older woman, which I love. And I did want to get back to what you said about Ross. And I don't want to spoil details, but she is going through something in kind of a way with a twist, obviously, to your world that I think a lot of people, myself included, would relate to in a personal, in a mental health kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something that a lot of us could relate to. And so even within the fantasy, you have built in kind of these human struggles that we're able to put ourselves kind of into, which is so great.
Well, thank you. I mean, a lot of our characters are having mental health problems, as you've noticed.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, I mean, you take your characters to some far places, but yet they don't lose kind of the relatability and the humanity, which is really great.
Well, thank you. My goodness, I'm blushing tonight. This has been so... This has been very flattering. I've enjoyed.
I
just
took
the audience out there and going, goodness, they're being kind to him. We're after harsh critique. That's what they'll be after.
No. We have, Kate and I were even talking before about how much we have both enjoyed the book. You know, we just so appreciate great contributions to Sherlock Holmes literature. But I have to say...
Go
ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, you were going to say, you must have had British authors on here before busily running away from your praise. I mean, this is what you did.
Well, you know, well, you have American babes today, so you got to take it today, but...
Yes, ma'am.
I do want to say, since we're talking about, obviously, fantastic female characters, you recently wrote for a show that we love, which is called Elementary. Oh, and yes. I know Kate is kind of the Elementary expert, so I will let her take over in a second. But I want to say one thing. You wrote, I believe it's the 17th episode of season 4, You've Got Me, Who's Got You, which aired in March, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I have to credit you with giving, I think, Sherlock Holmes my favorite origin story of all time, which is, I was bitten by a radioactive detective.
And I've got to say, I just, full disclosure, that's not my line. That's Rob Doherty's line. I'm so sorry.
We actually interviewed Rob on the podcast, and we love him very much as well. He is. Fabulous episode. Just absolutely, definitely my favorite Elementary episode that I've had the privilege of seeing. But I want to give over to Kate because she has some great questions.
It is a great line, by the way. That's why I feel I can't claim it for my own. Please, Kate, you go on.
Oh, yeah. I was telling Amy before, I'm like, you need to stop me because I just might talk about comics for 3 hours with him.
Do that.
Because as a comic book fan, I was watching the show, the episode, and halfway through, and I'm like, is this about Jack Kirby's kids trying to kill Stan Lee? And I just cracked up. It was so funny. It was just like, I loved it. And again, it went back to the idea of you, as an author, clearly know your history and you know the genre. And there was such joy in that episode. I it's hands down, I think, probably in my top 5 favorite Elementary episodes. And I would love to know how you came about writing it, because you don't typically write for the show.
Well, but Rob's also a huge comics fan. So both of us brought that knowledge of the whole swathe of, you know, the whole medium. He initially asked me to join the Elementary Writers' Room 4 years ago while it was being set up. And I got this phone call in my little house north of London, and I had to immediately turn him down because my wife can't leave Britain. That makes her sound like an international criminal. I mean, no, she's a priest. She's a vicar in the Church of England. And, you know, job opportunities for that abroad are very few. So I walked downstairs and sat down on the sofa beside her and said, I've just turned down an offer to go into New York and live and work on an American TV show. And she said, oh, okay. But it was a bit too big for either of us to deal with in that moment. But he kept saying, you know, pitch me something. And so in just the last year or so, I started taking him more seriously and started pitching a few ideas. And then around Christmas time, he suddenly said, yep, that one you just pitched, let's go for it. And I think he only has a couple of slots each year for visiting writers. And this was over the Christmas period. So I got the benefit of insight from his writer's room, and then they left for the holidays. And so it was just me and him working over Skype on Christmas Eve, stuff like that. And he's incredibly dedicated. We did it top to toe in something like 6 weeks.
Wow.
Immensely satisfying experience. He wrote the entire Joan plotline. That's all him.
Oh, okay, because that was my other question. Is one of the things about that episode that I love is she has this subplot, which it's amazing, and it has nothing to do with Holmes, because she actually has two. She has the bit about the clothing drive, which gives her a little bit of backstory and more Joan-ness that sometimes you kind of want more from the show, which was, again, one of the reasons I was just loving the episode. And then she has this whole toe-to-toe with Daddy Holmes, which is just, like, amazing. Amazing.
I suggested a couple of plot beats and the occasional line. That's almost all Rob. It's him keeping on going the arc of the season, you know. And it's brilliant. It's lovely to see Joan being manipulative like that. Well, not manipulative is the wrong word. Clever. Doing espionage.
She has so much agency, I feel, in that episode. She's completely in control. And again, it goes all the way back to what we talked about at the very beginning with this idea of, you know, the Brett version of Holmes finally being able to give Watson a little bit of his own character, not just the Nigel Bruce stuff, is that she finally felt like she was getting her own day, which was wonderful to see.
I've always felt that Rob felt really strongly about diversity in kind of the same way I do. And I think his Watson has been a revelation. I think it's an amazing part for Lucy Liu, and she does wonderful things with it. So yeah, I can only be a fanboy of that particular part of the episode.
I know, but, and I feel with his Watson, and I wonder if you want to speak to this in terms of writing her, was she has such boundaries with her Holmes of that they have very clear lines of who they are to each other. There's this one scene in the first episode, in the first season, where Holmes is very upset and he starts smashing things. And so they're in the kitchen and she takes a plate and she immediately smashes it after he smashes his. And she's like, all right, does that make you feel better? And it's this line of like, she's not going to put up with his antics in a way that you sometimes see other Watsons doing, and I just it's wonderful, I think, for her to be in that role and for Watson to be like that.
Well, I think emphasizing her role as carer of him, of somebody who has to set an addict boundaries and walls, is giving her it's emphasizing something from the original character of Watson that gets steamrolled by how Holmes in every version of the stories tends to steamroller Watson. But this time round, by emphasizing that, it gives her immediately more power, because she literally has power over him. In the first season especially, she can literally end his career here.
Yeah, that I love that, because it's like you're saying, there's definitely, through the canon, I mean, we're talking about 60 stories, these are two people who are friends over years and years, and there are shifts in dynamics over time, and there's not one single through line of, you know, who's dominant or who's, you know, who's doing what. And I think that echoes, you know, different kind of almost throwaway lines in the canon, where we hear about, you know, Watson at some point saying that he's helped Holmes to leave his drug habit behind or something like that, which is actually canonically based, but it's something people kind of, I think, sometimes read over because they see Holmes as more of a static character, where he's, you know, he's always at this age, he's always, you know, doing this thing, he's always taking cocaine, he's always this, but there's actually
progression. I really dislike that poem, you know, somewhere it's all where it's always 1895 or something like that. You know, that famous poem about Holmes?
Star It, yeah. The Vincent Star It 221B poem.
I actually wanted to put it at the start of the novel, but it's still in copyright because I really dislike everything it stands for. It's kind of a summing up of everything that's bad about Englishness, for a start. But it certainly is bad about Holmes, because it does say that these are not liquid characters in any sense. These are static archetypes. And I think Elementary really proves the fact that you can have two excellent modern day Sherlock Holmeses and have them immensely different from each other proves that this is a character that is immensely malleable and changeable, and you can always do interesting new things with.
Now that actually leads into my next kind of big question, is that Elementary's Holmes to me feels very different than, say, the BBC Sherlock, or say the Downey version, or the Brett version, or any of the other really popular ones. So approaching it from a writing perspective, what really did you need to focus on to make sure that you were writing this Holmes as he is in the show?
Oh, well, it's getting his voice, watching every episode, inhabiting the character's skin, getting his voice in your head and hers. And basically that need for precision, that the way he will talk in very long sentences and tire Johnny Lee Miller out, obviously, in order to get over everything he wants to say. And also the moral core. I think this Holmes emphasizes the moral core in a very interesting way. The end of my episode is, you know, we discover what could be a very flighty, very sort of silly story. It turns out to have a weight to it, a bit of a punch. My wife always says I write stories that are ha-ha-bang. And that's something Rob was very much into as well. He really wanted to emphasize Holmes's disgust at our protagonist at the end. And I think it's a building disgust. I think Johnny really conveys a sense of building disquiet, which pays off in that final scene. And
Excellent. We're kind of hovering between spoiler and non-spoiler on the episode, but
I'm carefully non-spoilering at the moment.
Right. There, that confrontation is really, really excellent, and I think that definitely comes through, that idea of Holmes as an agent of who has a personal strong sense of morality, definitely.
It was interesting. Rob added that line to my comic book scene where Sherlock is talking about how he feels about the superheroes portrayed in the comics, and the line was that they've got a very big attachment to justice, and Rob, who knows this character better than anybody, wanted that emphasized. So I think that's really close to the heart of elementary Sherlock.
I think that also goes back to the canon, is that one of the things Elementary does so well is it emphasizes the canon aspect of Sherlock did have its own sense of justice. In a way, he's like an 1895 social justice warrior in the sense of, you know, he has his morals. Sometimes he lets the criminals go. Sometimes he doesn't. Yeah. Sometimes he chases them down with a whipping stick.
But well, you're right, because what's really interesting is that if you're poor and honest, he's much more likely to let you go than if you're rich.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. There's a definite Robin Hood aspect to it. And I mean, it makes me think, Elementary makes me think of House N.D. a little bit, because House sort of hovers on that Holmes adaptation, not Holmes adaptation kind of line. And the way that Hugh Laurie plays that, he is a character with a very strong sense of personal justice and morality that sometimes doesn't dovetail with official justice channels, which is always a really interesting, interesting thing to see. But at the same time, I love that Elementary's Holmes is functional enough, and he is able to see the value of also working through official channels. Mm. Which I love to see that. I think it's, as you know, the PC term or whatever, it's a very pro-social message to say, you know, not everyone in the police is incompetent. You know, we should, for maybe, you know, younger people watching, it's not opposed to justice, which is a good thing, opposed to official channels.
Well, for a while, we were going very big on Holmes reacting badly to the idea of costume vigilantes. And them saying, actually, what's the difference between you and us? But after a while, we thought that's actually, it's a bit of a dry argument. There's not a lot of meat there. So we had Holmes just expressing a slight sigh at their silliness and leaving it at that.
Yeah,
there's also a lovely way in which Johnny plays that scene of meeting, slight spoiler alert, the second superhero, and the scene in the kitchen where he's just staring and he has this, I like to refer to it as his pouty face of just like, I don't quite know what's going on. I don't quite like you. I'm just pouting at you. And it's all kind of in the acting of expressing exactly what you were saying with to that kind of distrust and maybe, I don't want to say contempt, but caution.
A little bemusement.
The lovely thing about writing any home story, I discover, is getting all the information for those deductions together. You know, what are the printing chemicals that smell like that? You know, why would somebody be standing a particular way? You know, all that stuff.
Hours and hours of Google research.
Minutes and minutes.
it's targeted research. Well, and I love, this is not original to me, but it's actually an observation that Entertainment Weekly made in their article about your episode, which they were very positively impressed, but they were bringing up the fact that the particular writer said that it had not occurred to them how appropriate a superhero episode was in a meta way, because obviously Holmes, as we mentioned before, he's kind of the archetype of regeneration, of kind of continuities where somebody dies and doesn't die, you know, and that he's kind of an early proto-superhero. And I wondered if that meta quality fed into any of your desire to or decision to make that a theme of your elementary episode, the whole superhero thing against, like you were saying a minute ago, against Holmes, and what is he? Is he a superhero? Is he a regular human being? Kind of that question.
Well, Rob originally said to me, what about something about a real-life superhero? And pointed me in the direction of a documentary on the subject, which I watched. And then I thought, well, let's connect this to the business of superhero comics, which, you know, was a subject about which we could both, you know, go on and on. But the meta thing was kind of important for me. I didn't want it to be a tremendously meta episode. I wanted the comics industry portrayed to be very real, and actually for the real-life superheroes to be true to life to their real-life versions as well. My favourite thing in the whole episode, and this is ridiculous because it's not, it doesn't have any dramatic value at all, but it has a sort of woo fantasy value for me, is Sherlock mentioning in his list of the deaths of the Midnight Ranger, which are all real superhero modes of death, which superheroes have come back from. He includes going over the Reichenbach Falls.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Was that you or was that
Yeah,
Rob?
That was, oh, that was that, so me.
That's the best line. And also that scene is my favorite because I love when Joan walks in and she's like, this is an issue 10 from the 1940s. Why is it out of its bag? And Sherlock's like, well, how else am I supposed to read it? And as the comic book fan, I'm going like, you don't take it out of the bag. You find a scan. What are you doing? You know, and I loved that kind of like beat of Joan just being like, he's crazy. Why is he touching this comic? And it again, I love that episode. I could watch it for days and days. I think it goes back to what I said before. One of the reasons I quite like your writing is that you know when to add in those little moments and when to kind of keep it, you know, professional about the drama. And that balance is, again, it's very hard to find. And when you do it, you do it amazingly. And it was, and also I think the punch of it being this list and then, oh, and we go over the falls and you're just like, oh, I love it. It's so wonderful.
Well, you know, in a future episode, reviewing something else of mine way down the road, you'll be the ones going, no, you remember we said, well, this time he just fell off the tightrope screaming. It's just ridiculous. It's a wallow.
So, with future episodes, would you be open to writing more as a guest spot?
I wouldn't mind. I really enjoyed it, and I love Rob. He's laid back and gentle and calm. And he projects an atmosphere to his team of, oh, hey, this is just us doing our thing, it'll be fine. And that actually, I find, gets creativity going, that sense of calm responsibility lets you be creative much better than somebody yelling and screaming at you. I'm not saying he's laid back to the point of letting things go, because he's not. He's a stickler for detail, and he'll really push you and... You know, I remember one time I said, well, so do you want this new plot maybe tomorrow? He said, well, how about tonight? That was at 10 p.m. of my time. you know, you do it because you really like the guy. And, you know, I think it's a good way to motivate a team. So, yeah, I wouldn't mind. I'm trying to get my own intellectual... This is meant to be the year when I do my own intellectual property in all directions. And I've got a new manager who said to me, do you really want to be chasing individual episodes of TV shows now? And I kind of went, oh, well, yeah, kind of. And then finally decided she probably had the best idea. So this, I honestly don't know. Let's see. Maybe it'll have to be another Christmas Eve to do it.
obviously will be. I personally was really excited when I heard that you had written one. I genuinely promise I've been following your TV writing since Father's Day, so I was absolutely thrilled.
I'm really sorry about Robin Hood.
No, Robin Hood is the best. Don't be sorry about Robin Hood.
No apologies.
That show has a special place in my heart.
I wrote one scene in the second episode to which I received sole credit. The first Robin Hood, okay, I wrote a large chunk of that, but the second one, I think about 8 people wrote that.
Oh boy, that gets tough after a while.
There were some good people in the 8 people, but anyway, go on.
Oh yes, well, as she said, we have a love. We have actually, believe it or not, talked about that at length in one of our episodes for some reason. I don't know why. It was one of those Baker Street Babes random things we get off on. I do want to say to our listeners, episode 63 is where we actually interviewed Rob Doherty, if they want to check that out, because we have mentioned him a lot of times, and he kind of went into his process with actually brainstorming and starting Elementary, and then kind of what's continued to go into that. So if people want to check that out, they can. I do want to transition. I know we don't want to keep you forever, and we know it's getting late your time. One thing I love about this episode, which we've touched on a lot, is how anchored it is in the comics world, which, researching you a little bit before this discussion, a lot of, like, videos I found were you kind of at comic conventions and things like that, and I want to give you... well, just, you know, interviews here and there about work for DC, work for Marvel, other Vertigo, other comics, and I do want to give you a chance... Not just those, but I know you, I mean, your accomplishments with your TV writing, your audio dramas. I just want to give you a chance to highlight any of your other work that you might want to mention that our listeners might want to check out.
Well, I've got some more comics coming up this year, but I can't say a word about them yet. My Litchford books. I'm the author of a novella called Witches of Litchford, which is about 3 very different women who come together in a little English market town to battle the forces of evil as represented by a new supermarket chain. And, that's a lot of comedy, a lot of sort of lovely, gentle village stuff, but also some real horror. And that's Witches of Litchford. And I've got a sequel to that coming out this Christmas. And it'll be a Christmassy book. And they're novellas. So they're an afternoon read. And they're in Tor's novella series. And I'm delighted by how well those have done. And they're especially pleasing to my little local town. Because it's sort of set here. Mm. And except with added black magic. And those 3 women are... of different age groups, different belief systems. One is an atheist magic shop owner, which really annoys one of the other is her best friend, who's a vicar. And well, so you can either... We're surrounded by magic. Could you at least believe in it? You know, and and there's a very an old battle-axe elderly witch who's who reluctantly agrees to take them both on as kind of her charges. So I'm very pleased with the Litchford books. And there's also I've just got a collection together of a comic I did for Dark Horse called This Damned Band, which is a terrible title for a comic, because if you Google it, all you'll get is photos of the damned, and I really should have thought of that. But it's about the biggest rock band of 1974 who like to say, "We worship the devil," only to discover, to their utter surprise and horror, that actually they've been worshipping the devil. It's, again, comedy, but with a lot of horror. Mm-hmm. And very proud of that lovely artwork. Got to do the discographies in the back without little album covers and all that.
Oh, that's fun. That is fun.
Yeah, so thank you for giving me an opportunity to blurb other stuff. I really appreciate that. You've been such nice hosts.
Oh, well, thank you for coming on. And go ahead, Kate, sorry.
I was going to say, you're welcome.
And I'm so glad you liked Who Killed Sherlock Holmes. I'm title-wise, I really shouldn't have put a question. I've got a book with a question mark at the end of the title. So every time I put it in a tweet or in a blog post and carry on the sentence with a lowercase, it just hurts. It's annoying.
But see, it's in that sense, it's a very memorable title because it has the punctuation mark. So you're getting, I think, it stays in your mind. I do want to make sure we let our listeners know where they can find you. I know your website is paulcornell.com, if I'm not mistaken. And where can they find you, maybe on social media?
I'm Paul_Cornell on Twitter. And I have a public Facebook page, which if you Google my name, you'll find, I'm sure. I never know how to put over Facebook addresses. Oh, and I have a regular podcast. I do the Cornell Collective, which can be discovered at geekplanet.com, where I interview every month a prose writer, a TV writer, and a comic writer who get to meet each other.
Oh, that's lovely. Excellent.
That sounds so fun.
Well, it's by no means as good as your own podcast, but it's my little hope, and I love it.
Well, we have many listeners who love podcasts, so we will definitely send them that way. And I do want to make sure that we let them know when and where they can find Who Killed Sherlock Holmes. Where is the best way for them to get the book?
It's out on May 19th, and basically, all good online bookstores that you may have heard of will have it. And American bookstores in physical form, probably best to order it. But you'll find it online on Kindle, in paperback. And we're just talking about an audiobook. So there are audiobooks of the first two, and I'd love that to happen, particularly if Damien Lynch, my wonderful narrator, gets to do the third one. So, yes, May the 19th is the launch date. Oh, goodness. I'm appearing at Forbidden Planet in London that night, and another one in Bristol the following weekend. And I've promised to buy beer for everybody who buys the book. So,
oh, well, excellent. For any of our listeners who might be in that area, you heard it here. That's where Mr. Cornell will be. So
I have the trouble feeling it's like one of those teenagers who invites everybody on Facebook over for a party. Is it going to be some sort of...
I love that.
Well, the good news, Paul, is that we sold every copy. The bad news is that the store burnt down. But
I love that. And also, we've heard from your publisher that we will have some giveaway copies for our UK listeners. So for people tuning in, stay tuned and we'll let you know how you can enter those giveaways. Well, thank you so much again for being on. This has been a great discussion, and we will also, I'm sure, review the book, which we love very much. And we appreciate your time so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?